Welcome to The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. This hour, you're going to meet someone who was an answer on Jeopardy. That's how good she is about making you care about natural disasters. Dr. Lucy Jones' book is called Big Ones, How Natural Disasters Have Shaped Us and What We Can Do About Them. New details have emerged about the Washington State family that was killed last month when they drove off a California cliff. Documents obtained by the Seattle Times show the extent of child abuse allegations against the mothers of the six adopted children. Oregon state officials knew about the family's history of alleged child abuse, but ultimately, Oregon decided there wasn't enough evidence to take action. Seattle Times reporter Nina Shapiro is here. Thank you, Nina, for coming.
Thanks for having me on.
We're talking about the Hart family, the mothers, Jen and Sarah Hart, and six children, two of whom are still missing. What did the state of Oregon know about the family?
Well, they knew quite a lot. It was quite stunning when we got the documents yesterday and saw just how many accusations they were aware of. So it wasn't just accusations that they heard from their time in Oregon. And two people called in separately to complain about abuse while the family was living in Oregon. But in addition to that, there were a whole series of allegations that occurred when the family lived in Minnesota. And there were six separate allegations and incidents that they knew of from that time.
So what kind of allegations?
Well, it was quite consistent. It ranged from actual beating. So there was a domestic assault conviction that one of the women had from what she described as a spanking that got out of control. But there were also numerous allegations of withholding food from the kids. And in Minnesota, the kids would come to school and they were frequently taking food from other people. Or one of the girls said to a school nurse one day that she hadn't eaten that day. And when the children were interviewed, they talked about being punished by not being given a meal and then sent straight to bed. There were also these strange accounts of the women putting the children to bed or in a corner or in a darkened space for hours at a time as punishment. There was a case that came in, this was in Oregon, where the children, because of some pizza that was eaten in the middle of the night, were put in a room, all of the children lined up with face masks over their faces and kept there for 5 hours, just doing nothing.
I want to ask about how Oregon officials, what they made of allegations like that. I do want to add a detail that is the reason why some people already have known about this family, and that is that famous photograph of a black boy hugging a cop. Will you just tell us what that was about?
Right. So that was at a protest in Oregon over police brutality, and the boy, whose name was Devante, was shown hugging a police officer. He was a child who frequently wore this sign that said free hugs around him, and he did on that day. There's a whole free hugs movement. And there were tears streaming down his face. And so at the time, it was seen as and described as this very moving incident and kind of an outreach to police officers. But you have to wonder, looking back, if there was something else going on when the child was crying.
Yeah. That photo was on Facebook pages, et cetera, all over. So, as you said, there had already been incidents reported about the Hart family from when they lived in Minnesota. Oregon child welfare officials knew about those reports and a couple in Oregon. So what do we know about why they decided that Sarah and Jen Hart could still be parents to these kids?
So they interviewed the family, including the children, and they interviewed the children one by one, and the children said that they were treated fine and that there wasn't any abuse happening. The children were also taken to a doctor. The doctor showed almost all of them as being below normal weight and growth, and yet still expressed no concern about that. And that seemed to be the reason why they came up with this determination. I think the puzzling thing is, you know, the determination was that there was some reason to believe that neglect and mistreatment might have occurred, but not enough to say that it had occurred. And yet there was no follow-up whatsoever. So the family actually lived in Oregon for 4 years after that, before they moved to Washington. And you would think that given everything they knew, and given the fact that they decided there was some reason to believe some abuse had occurred, that there would be some kind of follow-up, but that's apparently not how they do things.
Well, state officials are generally reluctant to separate families. I mean, how much can you know as a reporter about whether this was an unusual case of evidence, allegations being ignored?
I think that's true, and it's easy to look back in hindsight. When you do look back in hindsight, it just seems to be such a volume of evidence that it seems like it's pretty clear what was going on. When you're in the moment trying to assess, maybe not, to give them the benefit of the doubt. But I think, you know, another thing that's going on in this case is that the children were taken from other families, you have to remember,
mm-hmm.
back in Texas. So the Harts adopted these children. They're two sets of siblings from Texas. And, you know, at least one of those families have said, you know, they're so quick to take children from us, and yet these children were left with the Harts. So
what did they mean by take so quick to take children from us?
I think I'm presuming, you know, it's a family of color. It's a poor family. The mother was addicted to drugs, so there's that. And that's often a reason why children are taken away. But when you say the state is reluctant to separate families, well, I think yes and no. I mean, there's an argument to be made that in some cases they might be acting too quickly. You know, there's a whole lot of things that go on to those decisions, but certainly in the case of this one family, the kids had been living with an aunt, and there are questions about whether they really should have taken those kids from the aunt and put them with the Harts.
What did Jen and Sarah Hart say in their defense?
So both in Minnesota and in Oregon, they presented themselves as misunderstood. They lived an alternative lifestyle. They were a lesbian couple. They were vegetarians. They were part of this music festival community. They did yoga. And they presented that by way of saying, you know, people see them as kind of weird. And then, you know, the race also played in, and the fact that they were gay. So I think they presented this as, you know, people are targeting us because we're a lesbian couple and we have kids of color. And then the other thing that they would consistently say is that the children had a whole lot of issues because of their biological families. So they kept telling people that the families they came from, you know, had problems with drugs, that the kids may have had drugs in their system, had been around violence, and that they had food issues. So that was another thing they kept saying, especially when these reports came in that the kids were taking food from other people or said they were hungry, and the Harts would keep saying, you know, because of their background, they had food issues. So it was really interesting. One of the things that was in these Oregon documents is a statement from a Minnesota worker who talked to an Oregon official and said, you know, these women look normal. And so when they talk about all these problems that the kids have, people tend to think it's the kids who have problems and not the parents.
Huh. Because a moment ago you were saying the parents are saying, oh, we're seen as weird, but this Minnesota child welfare worker says these women look so normal. What do you think that meant?
I think they meant they looked like middle-class white people. You know, one of Sarah was employed. She was a manager at a department store. They presented well, presumably. They were college-educated. Presumably, they were articulate. You know, in that sense, they seem normal. In one sense, because, you know, they were a lesbian couple, that wasn't so normal, certainly in the small Alexandria town they were living in. But whether that can be used as an excuse for everything that was going on, that seems dubious.
We're talking with Seattle Times reporter Nina Shapiro, who's been reporting on the disastrous story of the Hart family, who lived in Washington State briefly and died after driving off a cliff in California. So this family, the Harts, moved from Oregon to Southwest Washington.
That's right.
Last year. And how much did Washington State officials know about past problems, allegations?
So we don't know that, but what happened in Washington happened really quickly. So the kids had been coming over to one neighbor's house for quite some time, asking for food or in one case fleeing from abuse that she said happened. But the neighbor actually reported the incident or reported her concerns on March 23rd, and by March 24th, the family was gone. And then a couple of days later, they were found dead. So Washington CPS came out the day that the neighbor's report came in. You know, after that, they didn't have really any time to investigate.
What do we know about the death of the Harts and their children?
Well, we know that Jen was legally drunk. Jen was the driver, and we know she was legally drunk when they drove off the cliff. We know that Sarah and two of the children had allergy medication in their bodies, which may have made them drowsy. We know that the car seemed to be going at an above-average speed when it went over, and there were no marks at the site indicating that the car tried to brake. But beyond that, it's conjecture. But the authorities down there are saying that it may well have been that they drove over the cliff intentionally.
And Nina, what do you've done all this reporting, trying to piece together this terrible story, and what are you left with? What could we take away from this story?
Maybe that things aren't always as they appear, and you really never know what's going on inside someone's house. You know, Sarah and Jen had, at least on Facebook, presented this image of being very loving parents.
They were foster parents. They adopted six children.
Right. They had pictures of everybody smiling and doing outdoorsy things and going to farms and all that kind of stuff. And then behind the scenes, this crazy and seemingly terrible stuff seemed to be going on. And you really just never know.
Is there any unanswered question for you? One big, you know, we still want to know this. There are still two children missing, but I don't know how that plays into what we do know.
Well, I guess I have to wonder if there were mental health issues going on, certainly with Jen, who seems to have been the driver in that relationship and controlling of a lot of the parenting behavior. So from a family point of view, you know, it's still unclear why things played out the way they did and why they were doing these kinds of behaviors, if indeed they were. And then from the point of view of officials, I would say the questions relate to what kind of follow-up they do and, you know, what happens in a case like this where there is a pretty extensive pattern of accusations, but where they can't quite prove it.
Yeah. We want to learn something, but we don't know whether that's going to happen. Seattle Times reporter Nina Shapiro telling us what we know and don't know about the Hart family. Up to the point at which they drove their van off a cliff in California. Nina, thanks for coming in. Thanks for telling us the story.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW, and we're going to be right back in just a moment. This is The Record on KUOW. We're live tweeting the show at KUOW, so join us. You use Amazon, probably, get stuff delivered. Hopefully it doesn't get stolen. Usually it doesn't. But if you worry about package theft, where do you send your stuff? One of those Amazon lockers, your neighbor's house, the mailroom at work? Is that cool? Well, starting today, Amazon will let Prime members in 37 cities, including Seattle, have packages delivered to their trunk, the trunk of their car. Car's got to be parked, right, Todd?
That's right. Yes.
Not moving cars.
No, not in motion. That would be another trick. I think they might have a patent on that already, but not yet.
This is co-founder and editor of the Seattle tech news site GeekWire. Todd Bishop is here to explain. Good to see you again.
Good to see you, Bill.
This is the same technology behind Amazon being able to drop a package off in my house? Is that the idea?
Essentially, the Amazon Key service for the house works in conjunction with a webcam called CloudCam. In this case, they don't actually have a camera in your car, but they work in conjunction with connected car services like OnCar to allow remote keyless entry, just like they would if you were locked out of your car. They allow the delivery person access to your trunk. And if your trunk can't be accessed, then as a second step, a plan B, they put it in your car.
Right. You have to have OnStar or OnCall. These are the roadside assistant services.
That's right. GM or Volvo are the primary launch partners at the beginning here.
And my 2000 Camry is not set up to have Amazon put stuff into my trunk, I take it.
Not yet, nor my 2007 Camry.
Oh, I remember the dueling humble guys.
Exactly.
So, these are modern, newer cars.
Yes, that's right. You got to upgrade to experience the Amazon lifestyle, apparently.
Uh-huh. Would you trust Amazon with your car key, Todd?
You know, that is a great question. And they go to great pains to try and reassure people. If you recall with the Amazon Key service, the whole notion of having someone essentially just dip inside your front entryway and drop off a package, even if it was on camera, it's a little creepy. Some people got creeped out by this. I could not convince my wife to let me, the tech guy, review this for GeekWire.
My overall impression was that thing got more thumbs down than thumbs up in public opinion. I don't know.
It certainly seemed that way anecdotally.
So far. So, we sometimes adjust.
Right. So with the car delivery service, it's been fascinating to see how Amazon has rolled this out. One of the primary images on the site is a delivery person who almost looks like a UPS delivery driver. And if you recall, this was one of the main criticisms of the Amazon Key service because they use their citizen package brigade to deliver this. So not only is it Amazon getting into your house, but it's some random dude who's driving. Now, random vetted dude who, that's what Amazon would call them, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. You know, they say they go through great pains to make sure these people are accredited and at least reliable to the extent that they can. But certainly, I think the issue of not necessarily privacy, but just personal space is a hurdle to any of these services when you think about somebody literally putting something in your car.
Yes. So now my car and my package can both get stolen simultaneously. That's only one police report. That's going to save me valuable time.
Hey, Jeff Bezos is nothing if not efficient.
I mean, I can get something delivered now outside my home, inside my home, at an Amazon locker, now in the trunk of my car. Are we missing anything?
Yes. The patents, I was joking about that earlier, but they in fact, well, drones.
Yes.
The drones, they in fact have also had these whole notions of drones going off of the UPS truck, and there's all sorts of crazy ideas for the ways Amazon could deliver packages.
Drone matching my car speed and delivering me food through my open window as I'm driving, just feeding it to me.
It's as if we've got a portal into South Lake Union right now, Bill.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to becoming an RVD, a random vetted dude. Also new, this is not an ad for Amazon, but it happens you also know about something else from Amazon. On rumors, anyway, of an in-home robot codenamed Vesta, which was a Roman goddess, right?
Of home and hearth.
Protector of home and hearth. Because you need your hearth was very important back then. You needed a god to protect your hearth. Fire was crucial. So a robot, what kind of robots are we talking about? Like,
when did your boss get here?
Any split second.
Where are the leftovers?
In the kitchen.
Never fear, while Rosie's here.
Rosie, the Brooklyn accented robot. Is it like that?
Exactly. Well, you've just got such a bead on the people in South Lake Union.
I really do.
So this, as you said, is merely a rumor at this point. It was a report from Bloomberg News. That said, a couple of very reliable reporters from that news service who have a lot of insights into this company. The notion is that it would essentially be a mobile Alexa. The notion being that you don't have enough Echo devices in your home already, if you're an Amazon fan, and you need that robot essentially to follow you around.
To follow me around and do what?
Well, serve your every need. they're saying it would.
Now we're back to feeding me.
That it would not quite do the dishes, but it based on the report, and again, it's hard to tell just based on these kinds of secondhand reports, but the notion would be that it would provide information, it would potentially offer services in different areas of the house that you could not get if it was just stationary. And of course, Amazon is no stranger to robotics. They had a big acquisition back in 2012 of a company called Kiva Systems that provides robotics to their warehouses. So it might seem like a stretch to have Amazon do this in your house, but in fact, they've been doing this. And one of the features that is reportedly being considered is autonomy. So it would be just like a self-driving car where it would essentially know how to get around your house, kind of like a Roomba.
Like a Roomba. So I know this wasn't your initial report, but do you know of a single task or piece of information I might want a robot for in my home? We're not even to that point of speculation yet.
Well, it is a bit of a struggle to come up with something valuable. And that is where maybe Amazon sees an unfulfilled need here.
Right.
One thing that I have seen actually in real life is a laundry folding robot.
Really?
And who would not want that?
It is one of the banes of my existence. It's something that you have to do over and over again. You can never really get ahead on. It's just going to, you're just always, it's rolling a rock up a folded hill. So, okay.
But to be clear, we do not yet know what Amazon might be doing. And the story was a little bit light on that kind of detail.
Okay. I appreciate that sort of skepticism. We're branding this as a rumor.
Exactly.
And we're just telling you about a rumor. Exactly. Some of those are interesting.
That said, it seems very reliable and it's also very logical. If you were to map out Amazon's product strategy based on what they have, where they could go, and the potential for technology, robots.
They're in my home in many ways. They're doing the artificial intelligence thing. You do the math.
They're specialists in robots already. Clearly, this is a likely place for them to go.
This is, as far as I know, a real person. Technology is really making it harder and harder to tell. But GeekWire editor and co-founder Todd Bishop, always good to see you.
It's great to see you too, Bill.
Thank you. This is The Record on KOW. Back in just a moment. It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. There's been a lot of hype about the new tunnel opening on Aurora Avenue.
When the new SR99 tunnel opens in Seattle, it will be one of the smartest tunnels ever built.
Aurora, the State Route 99 anyway, Paige, I don't know if you'd call that Aurora Avenue, but the new waterfront tunnel.
Yeah.
So smart, it turns out, costs money, right?
Yes,
that's why we're here. This is KOW's Paige Browning. She's here from our newsroom following the story to tell us how much this tunnel is going to cost and why. Hello.
Hello, Bill.
Lots of numbers in the story. You've got a good way to explain it, though. It involves lemonade, which I find promising.
Yes. So comparing the Highway 99 tolling to lemonade stand is really the simplest way I can do it. So just bear with me. First, the facts that Washington State Department of Transportation, WashDOT, they have to raise money to maintain the new tunnel,
and to pay back the construction costs for that tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the true story. In my explanation, let's pretend I'm WashDOT. Instead of owing money for construction, I owe you, Bill, $30. And to pay you back, mm-hmm. I start a lemonade stand. I have to buy lemons, I have to buy pitchers, hire my sister to run the stand.
You need a card table,
yeah,
or
exactly.
something.
I need a lot of equipment.
Yeah,
this
cups.
Is going to cost $50.
Uh-huh.
While I'm at it, I want to raise an extra $20 so I can clean the stand and repaint it at the end of it all.
Sure.
So now I have to raise $100 in selling lemonade to get you your $30 back. That's really what WashDOT is going to do over the next 25 years. They need to raise about $1 billion in tolls, with about half of that going to just operate the toll system and the rest to pay their construction debt and maintain the tunnel. That's really simplifying it, but that's the gist.
Okay, so then Paige, thank you. That's an excellent example. So why wouldn't you just get me my $30 a different way, Paige?
Ah.
Have a yard sale or something.
Right, well, the Washington State Legislature mandated it to be this way. About 10 years ago, when the state was trying to figure out how to pay for the tunnel, they decided drivers who use the road need to pay for part of it. So they required that lemonade stand, or in this case, tolling.
Okay, so just the idea that they want this user fee
mm-hmm.
means, hey, it's expensive, but we're going to have this
Drivers,
system.
You need to pay part of it.
Yeah. Okay, so what would be some of the other ways to raise the money? And why are those other ways off limits?
Sure. So there's not really another way to charge just the drivers who use the road. But, you know, you could raise money by using a different tax, maybe an income tax.
Ha!
Yeah, that's a non-starter. We don't have income taxes in Washington.
Uh-huh.
Or how about a gas tax? Well, actually, the gas tax is already paying a big chunk of the Highway 99 tunnel cost. That's already applied, but it's applied to drivers throughout the state, not just those people who use it.
Paige, in your story, you said that other tolling systems have failed. What happened in those places?
Yeah, it's happened in San Diego. It's happened north of Baltimore and in a few other places. Basically, their overhead cost, the cost to buy the lemons and the pitchers, it was more than they were bringing in through the tolls, so it failed.
Well, yeah, that's what you made it sound like, that it can be very expensive that way. So what are the odds this happens in Seattle?
I would say it's not likely that this would fail. I'm not a tolling expert, I should say. But, you know, it's more likely to fail in areas where not enough people are using the tollway, so they're not really bringing in any revenue.
Yeah, I lived in Florida where they did a tollway, and it turns out people just didn't much use it.
Right, yeah, they maybe could skip it.
Yeah.
But, of course, our region already successfully sustains other tollways. Interstate 405 express lanes, 520 bridge over Lake Washington, et cetera.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And there are too many ways to get through downtown Seattle.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. Drivers only have one other option to divert to downtown Seattle traffic. It's already congested.
And if there were a shortfall, well, gee, we are tolling people. Would they just jack up the tolls?
Some tollways they would, not on the State Route 99 tunnel. They are already worried that people are going to skip the tunnel and go downtown. They're also worried that people will drive across Seattle and take I-5. And WashDOT cannot risk having more congestion downtown or more congestion on I-5. So the Washington State Transportation Commission is being very careful to charge as low a toll as possible.
Many, many constraints. Okay, Paige Browning, when's this tunnel supposed to open?
Okay, the tunnel's scheduled to open sometime this fall. They won't start tolling until a few months later, maybe early 2019. Because basically they first want the drivers to use the road for free, see if it works for them. Once they're hooked, they'll start to pay the tolls.
KUOW reporter Paige Browning making sense of the fuzzy math and using lemons to do it. This is the math that's leading WashDOT, our Department of Transportation, to raise about $1 billion in toll to pay off a $330 million construction debt. And for the numbers on that deal, we're tweeting out a link to Paige's story. And Paige, thanks for coming in and relating it to us. It's The Record on KUOW Seattle, the big ones, and what we can learn from them, how they shape us. We are going to talk with someone so well known in California for earthquakes? That she's a Jeopardy question. Stay tuned. This is The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. There will be a time, could be tomorrow, could be 100 years from now, when the ground beneath us will start to shake violently. So hard it's going to bring you to your knees if you're standing. Buildings will crumble. Roads will be destroyed. And then a 60-foot wall of water will crash onto the Washington coastline. The West Coast is a ticking time bomb. The big earthquake will come. Will you be ready? Well, you could, says my next guest. Dr. Lucy Jones is the author of the new book, The Big Ones. I think she's America's most famous seismologist. Welcome, doctor.
Thank you for having me.
I mean, you were in a Jeopardy question.
Yeah, that's actually happened twice. I'm still
twice.
Still can't quite believe it.
How was that? I know about one of them. What were the Jeopardy? I guess you were a Jeopardy answer.
I was a Jeopardy answer. There was one about the movie The Rock, with The Rock, the San Andreas movie.
Yes.
And it was something about Paul Giamatti and I can't even remember now what the question was.
I can quote it. Seismologist Lucy Jones found fault with this film, saying you can't predict quakes as Paul Giamatti's character does.
There you go.
Answer San Andreas.
The San Andreas. That movie was,
It they played fast messages. And loose?
It had some good messages about emergency response and how you plan. The science was non-existent.
Uh-huh. This is a scientist I'm talking to, a seismologist, and you write that natural disasters stem from the same forces that give our planet life. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, to live in this world, we need to have the carbon cycle, we need to have the water cycle, we need to have rain coming in and watering our plants. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, though, that also leads to occasional floods. Mm. We need to keep nutrients in the soil. One of the things the volcanoes give you are wonderful soils that are very good for producing crops. Unfortunately, they also occasionally erupt.
We have good farmland here partly because of that history, right?
Absolutely. I mean, this Pacific Northwest is sort of archetypal natural hazards land. You've got these beautiful mountains, which give you landslides. You have the slush forest because of all the rain and therefore all the flooding. You have the tsunami and the earthquake and the volcano. I mean, we're really rather impressed and elsewhere in the world at how you bring it all together. And it is why it's so beautiful here.
Yes.
It's absolutely part and parcel of the whole thing. And so it's just that all of these systems that move things around the earth and make life possible have extremes. And anytime you have a river, you've also got floods. Anytime you have a volcano, you have eruptions. You know, and we've got to think of it. And I think the difference here is that I'm an earth scientist. So I can talk about 10,000 years as recent, and it is recent. It's normal, right?
Yes.
I think on a different time scale than most people do.
Yeah. How does your thoughtful perspective help me when the ground is shaking like crazy?
Well, it helps you understand that this is just a natural process and you could have done something. Maybe it doesn't help you if you haven't done it before. Beforehand, it can help you realize that it's worthwhile doing this stuff. But human beings don't want to go there. We're so afraid of the random out of the blue hit that we obsess about it. So when people think about the big earthquake coming, what are they thinking of? They're afraid of dying.
Yeah.
Right?
That's on my list of fears.
Yeah. But, I mean, even in Pompeii, 90% of the victims made it out alive. Right?
Pompeii, this is about right about the year zero, right?
Right. In Italy. 79, Vesuvius erupts.
Yeah.
The town's completely buried. The whole city leaves human knowledge for 1,500 years. But 90% of the victims still got out alive.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're just probably not going to die.
Hmm.
What's really at risk is our societies. What sort of a city will Seattle be after that big earthquake comes through and the tsunami hits? And number one, we've done such economic damage to our buildings. You know, we have buildings we know will fall down. And I understand that you guys are debating whether or not to try and deal with the unreinforced.
For years, Dr. Jones, Seattle and Washington State, we've been debating and debating and debating.
And they will kill people when the earthquake hits. Absolute. No question about it.
The former King County Emergency Management Director says our buildings are so dangerous and have been for so long that when an earthquake kills people, everyone involved in not taking action should be charged with manslaughter.
that's an extreme way of looking at it, but yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, the reality is we know, and you are choosing not to do anything about it because you're so obsessed about that time. Is it today? Is it tomorrow? Is it 100 years? That becomes the only thing we think about.
I thought we were obsessed with money because we, I mean, isn't that a big part of it? We talk about mandating these seismic retrofits, but the question has been, who's going to pay for that?
The problem is it's an obsession with the short-term money. In the long run, you will save money by doing the retrofitting. There have been studies that show we save $6 for every dollar spent on retrofitting in the long run. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem. We aren't willing to give it that time. And that's where I'm saying the geologic perspective. I look at this and just can't understand it.
I see.
It's absolutely inevitable. One of the problems, I think, you know, when we talk about the earthquake, you'll hear, you know, the chance of it happening in the next 30 years is 10%, 15%, whatever it is for up here. And it sounds, you know, if you heard that there was a 15% chance of rain today and then it didn't happen, well, all right, the risk is gone.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not in Seattle. In Southern California, we're sure, okay, now it's over, right?
Yeah.
And we use that same words. The problem is it's not that we know anything about 30 years. We use 30-year probabilities because that's the length of most people's mortgages and therefore a time frame in which they're making financial decisions. What we know is the earthquake is absolutely 100% certain to happen as long as you give me enough time.
Well, yeah, but that's a pretty hugely important variable. I sleep well because of that variable.
yeah, but I wouldn't sleep well in an unreinforced masonry building.
Well, actually, in Seattle, I wonder how do you think we're how worried should we be about an earthquake in Seattle? Assuming I'm home, I'm not sleeping on an ocean beach.
It is in the lifetime of most of your younger listeners, it will be happening.
Yeah.
In their lifetime. You know, once or twice every 50 years, that's not that often compared to other things, but we can tell you what's going to happen because of it.
Are we talking about something much worse than the 2001 Nisqually quake? I remember. I was there. And it was, you know, I got a crack in my wall and it shook me around. And
that was what I was talking about. It depends. What it's like, though, depends on where you are with respect to the earthquake. How close were you to where the earthquake happened? I mean, if you're right on top of it, it's going to be quite a bit worse than some distance away.
Right, right. I suppose I was about somewhere under an hour away from the center of
it. Then you were so far away that you really shouldn't be having any damage whatsoever. And if you do, that implies your building isn't in great shape.
You said that we don't think of it as you're going to die, right?
Right.
Why is that? Why isn't it good to think, uh-oh, I'm going to die if I don't do all the right things?
Well, it's just, I can see I'm a scientist. It may be successfully manipulating you, but it isn't true. You know, most people, in Southern California, we estimate 99.99% of people will live through our big earthquake. Now, you are far more likely here, as well as in LA, to be killed on the freeway. You're more likely to be murdered, quite a bit more likely to be murdered than you are to die in the earthquake.
Well, thanks.
Yeah, it's a wonderful part of American life. But, and the problem is, if we're focusing on that, we can't seem to focus on the money aspect. You really should be worried about being bankrupted by the earthquake. Because if you've now lost your house and the building where you're going to work is badly enough damaged that they won't let you in, and the water pipes are disrupted and the sewers are disrupted, how many people stay when they haven't had a shower in a month?
Yeah.
And then the city, what's at risk is not our lives, it's our society.
What do you mean by that?
Meaning that the cities will struggle to survive through this. You can look at San Francisco in 1906. It was many, many decades before it got back any of the standing that it had had before. I mean, in 1905, San Francisco was the New York of the West Coast, the only one that mattered.
Mm-hmm.
The decade after 1906 is the biggest growth decade in the history of Los Angeles. We were one-fifth the size of San Francisco before that earthquake, and we're now five times the size of San Francisco. And so there are fundamental shifts like that. Or think of Portugal. One of the stories in my book is of the Lisbon earthquake of 1755. When that earthquake happened, Portugal was a major colonial power. It had Brazil. It was very rich. It was set back enough by that basically they never recovered. And Portugal is not a significant city, you know, in the or state in Europe, and it lost its colonial standing because of all of this.
Maybe they were punished for being colonizers.
Well, at the time, we definitely believed that it was God's wrath that was why the earthquakes were happening.
The book that you mentioned is called Big Ones, How Natural Disasters Have Shaped Us and What We Can Do About Them, and the author is Dr. Lucy Jones. And we would have plenty of warning before a Mount Rainier eruption, right? I don't worry about that one.
Okay, so there's where you're focused on your life safety issues. Yes, you will probably have a warning. I do say probably. You remember Mount St. Helens in 1980? We had 3 months where it was obvious that there was undergoing unrest.
Steaming.
Right, and the magma was moving from deep in the earth to closer to the surface. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that unrest will just stop and you don't have the eruption. So we will have a warning, but we won't have a 100% certainty warning.
So we'll just figure,
it depends on how you respond. I mean, people were still living there near Mount St. Helens and died in that eruption because they didn't listen about leaving.
Hmm. Hey, a listener named Josh here in the U District where you are right now wrote to us and asks, I'm wondering if the Space Needle is the safest place to be in Seattle during an earthquake. I don't know why the Space Needle would be the safest place.
I cannot imagine.
Maybe he thinks it'll sway, like the Earth will be freaking out underneath it, and it'll just wave a little bit.
There's a couple of things. One is that we need to remember that
nothing's fallen on top of you if you're in the Space Needle.
It was built before you had significant seismic building codes in Washington.
Okay.
And that's a major issue. Right? Your building is only as good as the building code in place when it was built and the degree to which it was enforced. And even our current code doesn't say, let's have a good building. It says, don't kill me. Mm. So if the building's a total financial loss, but you crawl out alive, that was a success.
That's a win.
And there's where I worry about the economic issues.
Mm-hmm.
Because imagine now the new buildings in Seattle, maybe 10, 20% of them are so badly damaged you aren't allowed to use them. What's your economic outcome then?
Dr. Lucy Jones, you live in Southern California.
I do.
Earthquake country. So how woke are you?
I choose
to stay there.
I choose to stay there. There's a few reasons because just like everybody else, I have other factors that go into my decisions. I have a good job there. I'm a fourth generation Southern Californian. I like the sunshine. It's just not that big a risk to my life.
What's your house like? Do you have walls made entirely of plastic water bottles?
Oh, that's an idea. Now, I have a 1948 house, but every time I've bought a house, I've brought in a foundation specialist to look at it and help me understand if there's anything we could do to make it safer.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a little extra work. I think we spent about $200 on this house, but it made it got rid of a vulnerability.
You actually wrote that water bottles are a little overrated.
Well,
you think that's going to help you out? There's other things you could
do? All right. I would not say don't get water bottles because we are going to lose our water system.
Yeah.
And that's actually a really critical one. But if I had to choose between storing water and getting my house retrofitted, I'd get my house retrofitted.
Make the pipes flexible and strong and
that's
the water.
I mean, this is one of the things that's happening in Los Angeles. I spent the year of 2014 in the mayor's office, and together we developed a set of plans for how to make us more seismic resilient. And it ended up passing all the things that required ordinances passed unanimously through city council. We got it through. One piece of it is a overhaul of the water system in Los Angeles. It's a very long-term effort because the water system is very expensive, but the city has made a commitment to seismic-resistant pipes, which is going to make that probably, if I only got one thing, that's what I'd want because that's the economic future of the city after the earthquake happens.
We're talking with earth scientist, seismologist Dr. Lucy Jones. The mayor of L.A. said when the big one hits, people will be alive because of the work she has done to prepare. One thing about natural disasters, doctor, they're very localized. A Texas hurricane and a Philippines typhoon don't physically affect me. Will climate change be a disaster that actually unites us?
Hopefully, because climate change, number one, absolutely happening. Number two, it is increased heat in the atmosphere. Heat is energy. The atmosphere now has more energy to contribute to storms. The rate and intensity of our big storms are all going up. And So we are going to be seeing more damage from hurricanes, from tornadoes, from typhoons, from extreme storms, from atmospheric rivers. The rate of all of these are going up, and they're going to be affecting all of us. There's also another big change in the world, though, of globalization. Right? We are much more interconnected than we used to be. Even, you know, whatever the economic system, we have the telecommunications. When the tsunami hit Japan, we all watched it in real time move over the Sendai Plain. Right? So we have a more visceral connection to people around the world. And that's the good part. It means that we are able to feel connected to the victims and have more empathy. And it helps us take our risks more seriously. Americans are much more concerned about tsunamis now because of what they saw happening in Japan and Sumatra. The bad side is we're also more economically and even physically connected. We have concentrated into cities. These cities are dependent on complex engineering systems. Systems fail where they're already weak. And anything less than the perfect system is a vulnerability. So I talked about the loss of water pipes or of sewers. You know, when that happened in 1906, in that earthquake in San Francisco, people built outhouses in their backyards and went on.
Mm-hmm.
We lose the sewer system now. It is a major public health crisis for a city. But our and then the third piece is our economies are connected now, too. So that if we really wipe out the, you know, chip production in Taiwan, it's going to be affecting the economy of anywhere, of Silicon Valley, Silicon Beach, all of the electronic high-tech companies, and we're all going to be struggling with that. So globalization is, as I think, better for human society. It's better for our ethical development, but it means that we are collectively more at risk from everybody's disasters.
She has written about disasters ethically, socially, economically, physically. She's an earth scientist, seismologist, Dr. Lucy Jones, author of the new book, Big Ones, How Natural Disasters Have Shaped Us and What We Can Do About Them. And the proper pronunciation, tsunami. Thank you for that.
Yes.
Yes. Dr. Jones, a pleasure to meet you. Thanks for writing this and coming in.
Thank you for having me.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. Back in just a moment. The Record on KUOW, live tweeting at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. The man accused of plowing a van into pedestrians in Toronto has been charged. 10 counts of first-degree murder, 13 counts of attempted murder. The 25-year-old man did not enter a plea this morning. Here with the latest, Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Hello, Vaughn.
Hello, Bill.
I understand the police chief says this looked deliberate.
Yes, police chief just wrapped up a press conference in Toronto. The mayor of Toronto, the coroner who's dealing with it, and the police sergeant who's investigating, all wrapped up this morning. A couple of things that we didn't know until noon today, perhaps the most disturbing, is they say there's some indication from the injured, who now number 14, and the victims, numbering 10, that they, as a group, they are predominantly female. There is some suggestion there that they may have been targeted by the driver of this van. We've had today confirmation from Facebook that just before he launched, or the accused launched the attack, he posted something on his Facebook site in sympathy to the incel movement. Incel, short for involuntary celibacy.
Yes.
And it's a misogynistic group, right? There's a link to an attack that occurred in the United States near Santa Barbara 4 years ago. And so there is a disturbing suggestion here, not confirmed completely by the authorities here, that these victims may have been targeted in the sense that they are also predominantly female. They have not identified anyone yet. They're saying it's very difficult because it was an open-air public space, because of the number of victims, because of the different difficulties contacting relatives. And we've had some indication, Bill, that two of these people are South Koreans. It's a Korean district in Toronto where the attack occurred. And one of them is a Jordanian. So there is one name out there, a young woman, Anne Marie D'Amico, who worked for the Canadian office of a U.S. investment management firm. She's confirmed dead, but the authorities have not confirmed anything, and they say it may be later today, it may be tomorrow, before they get us some names.
Yes, you mentioned this involuntarily celibate so-called movement. This suspected attacker even mentioned this American killer, right,
from California. Right.
Okay, well, what happens next, Vaughn?
Well, identification is primary here. The court appearance this morning, the next one's the 10th of May. It's in the hands of the authorities. The investigation, too, they're obviously looking for any and all evidence they can get about the basis for this attack. They confirmed today they seized a cell phone from the accused at the scene. They have details on how the truck was rented. They're calling for anybody who witnessed this thing to please come forward, anybody who has video to come forward. And, of course, if you've been seeing the video of this, you know, Bill, that there is a very dramatic piece of video of the takedown of the suspect.
Yes, captured a few blocks away in a tense confrontation. This is Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer giving you the latest to what we now know about the man accused of plowing that van into pedestrians in Toronto. So we'll keep learning more. Vaughn, thank you for that.
Bye-bye, Bill.
Bye-bye, and thank you for listening to The Record today, produced by Amina El-Sadi, Allison Bruzek, Ajua Jimabrempong, Jason Pagano, our social media producer, Bree Ripley. We'll talk to you tomorrow.